It is Wednesday, March 5th, and we are starting almost on time.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
3:24. And we have a couple of issues before us today, but we have everyone is in attendance with the exception of Senator Lincoln.
She'll be here tomorrow.
And she'll be here as soon as she realizes we are gaveled in. We have before us today Senate Bill 74, which was held over from last week sometime. Let everybody get their packets out there. There is an amendment drafted. At the last meeting, we had an amendment number one, which was amended. And with the record reflected, Senator Lincoln has graced us with her presence, so we are all in attendance. Thank you, Senator Lincoln. Senator Seacon.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to remove amendment number one as amended.
Okay, there's a, like, withdraw that amendment. Is there objection to withdrawing that amendment? Hearing none. It is withdrawn. And we have another amendment before us, which somewhere in the packets. We have amendment number two.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seacon.
I'd move amendment number two.
Amendment number two is moved.
Haven't had an opportunity to read it. If you could just explain what the amendment does.
Basically, the amendment, Senator Lincoln, addresses the confusion that an applicant can request a shorter period for the extension if they want to. You'll see that on line 16 and 17. Shall be extended for 2 years or for a shorter period if a shorter period is requested by the holder of the approved plan. That removes the confusion that I believe both you and Senator Elton were talking about last time around.
We have a couple people here that were prepared to testify that are available for questions. Larry Dietrich from DEC is available. If you have any questions for him, Marilyn Crockett is available from AOGA. The Assistant AG, Brett Postman, is available. So, does anyone wish to, in the audience or the people mentioned, wish to testify in the amendment? Are your questions or objections? You still object?
No, I withdraw my objection, Mr. Chairman, because as I understand it now, that will be for one or, I mean, they can...
Whatever length of time they want.
Up to 2 years.
Yeah, I think the amendment's a pretty good work product. I'm glad to help fill over your suggestion to work on it. And I think it was a good compromise. Okay, well, since the objection is withdrawn, the amendment takes effect. And let's see. Marilyn Crockett is here and would like to testify. She's here by teleconference. Marilyn, you care to say a few words? Any questions of Marilyn Crockett? Hearing none. Is there anybody in the audience would like to testify on this bill? Is there anybody in the teleconference that would like to testify that hasn't testified? Are you done? What's the wish of the committee?
Move it.
Is that a motion? Senator Dyson moved, and we moved Senate Bill 74 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
As amended.
As amended. Senator Lincoln.
Yes, I have to object to ask you a question.
Okay.
It next goes to, I apologize, I don't have my packet in front of me, but goes next to finance or?
It goes to the floor.
To the floor?
If I'm not mistaken, my staff's not through that yet. No fiscal note.
Well, zero fiscal note.
And, you know, the other body will do the fine work on it, I'm sure.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, that's when I think about just moving it on to the next body. I just feel like that's kind of unfair, that we should do the best job possible over on this side. And I'm not saying that we haven't done that on this side.
For the record, I think we have. We held it up a week and a half. We, I think, worked out a good compromise on the amendment. And people's questions were addressed. And
I'm just not sure, Mr. Chairman, that, and I guess I can discuss that on the floor, but I'm just not sure that changing that time period is, I still have a concern about, not the amendment, because I think the amendment was a good compromise, but just the overall. So I'll withdraw my objection.
Okay. So there's no objection to moving the bill. Get it out of here. Next, we have before us Senate Bill number 79 by Senator Ben Stevens. Senator Stevens, are you preparing your legislation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an act extending the termination of the Alaskan Minerals Commission. And the Mineral Commission is set to expire February 1, 2004. So this bill would extend them for 10 years until the year 2014. As we know, the Mineral Commission was established in 1986, charged with making recommendations to the governor and legislature in ways to mitigate constraints on development and mineral resources in Alaska. The 11-member commission, 5 by the governor appointment, and 3 by the president of the Senate, and 3 by the House. I think that the commission has done an excellent job over the last, 16 years. Some of the highlights of recommendations that have been adopted include the passage of the Minerals Policy Act, funding for the airborne geophysical surveys, creation, assisting in the creation of a task force for RS-2477 trail inventory, and for the assertion of the 2477 right-of-ways. Joint Resolution 31 passed in opposition of international parks, world heritage sites, and marine biosphere against the creation of those protection rights. And it seems to be working well, Mr. Chairman, and I think we ought to give it, make it so it can continue to do the good work and help us and guide us through some of these issues. There is one thing I wanted to point out in their executive summary. I don't know if you had a chance to look at that. But on page 7 of their executive summary on their annual report to the legislature for 2003, you'll see some similar recommendations that came from the mining industry towards the governor and the legislature. Elimination of frivolous litigation by limiting public interest litigants. We've just seen that recently. Increase efficiency in project permitting. Updating water quality standards. Assist in the infrastructure development that benefit mining and other industries that have to do with developing our resources. Land tenure, navigability, and right-of-way issues. And the continuation of the requirement of baseline geological environmental knowledge. So I think that these are good recommendations on the right track. Mr. Chairman, I encourage the committee to pass this bill on. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Do any of the members have any questions? We have, Senator Ellison.
Do you have people at this one?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We have Lance Miller in the audience. Lance, care to testify?
Yeah, hello, my name's Lance Miller, and I'm the Executive Director of the Juneau Economic Development Council. Prior to this position, I was Projects Manager with Placer Dome in Eurasia, and also worked on the Donovan Creek Project, and then I worked for Echo Bay for 9 years, where I was Chief Geologist of the AJ Project. I think you've heard the highlights of the commission and what it's done, and I think the one thing I wanted to bring up, because this is expanding its tenure, its length, more than previous, is essentially when we have industry coming in here now, the minerals industry being a $1 billion industry, the third largest in the state, when these companies are kind of moving in here and committing their capital over the course of 10, sometimes 20 plus years just to get something going, we realize now mines take at least 10 years these days to get built. That I think if the commission is in existence for at least 10 years running, that actually sends a good message to the industry. Basically, in sum, if they're going to commit their capital to that kind of risk capital for that time frame, just in the hopes of getting a mine going, I think if the state can have the commission extended for 10 years, that just shows goodwill to working in partnership with the industry. So that's really all I have to say. I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Does anyone have any questions? I guess I do. What was the previous, do you happen to know the previous amount that was extended every time?
5 years.
5 years. Isn't that? So that one is correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Anybody else? Got off easy.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you.
Okay. Neil McKenna.
Neil McKinnon, I'm the vice chair of the Minerals Commission and president of Hayak Mining Company, which is a small Juneau-based exploration company, essentially. And I don't know how long I've been on the commission, but I've been through several five-year extensions, and I can tell you that 5 years comes real fast. And probably, maybe one point I'd like to make, other than, you know, we all think we do a great job, and I suppose we personally think we do, but one of the things you get out of the Mineral Commission is when it's time to write the report, the volume of bytes transferred across my email or any indication that this fall I was plugging it several days in a row just from the reports and amendments and changes going back and forth. So there's a vast amount of work that the members do that doesn't really show up in the budget because we just do it to do it. And excellent support from the staff. But it's a large amount of work that goes into writing this report, putting it together, and getting to say what it needs to say in a way that's positive, I suppose. And the other side is that it's kind of a very diverse group, from placer miners to us in the case of small exploration company, and then we have the large companies like Cominco and Greensburg that are represented. And so there's a vast array of views that it doesn't end up in arguing out these positions and before we bring them to put them in the report. It kind of takes a more overarching view of our problems versus what one company is in the trenches and fighting a battle, they tend to look at it in more parochial interest and try to see if we can broaden, you know, the problems that are all of our problems, and looking ahead in places that typically with companies, until they have a problem, then it becomes a problem that they want to try to deal with, and we're trying to look ahead to say, you know, here's something that's coming down the road, and we need to watch for this, and give legislature and the administrative branch kind of a heads up that, you know, these things are coming. One example is the essential fish habitat, which we picked up on the radar screen several years ago. It's kind of a brewing problem that hasn't really come to the forefront yet, but it's kind of hanging back there. Not that there's much of, you know, asking you to do other than we just call it your attention. Is that advice?
Yes, thank you. What does essential fish habitat mean? I understand what it means physically, but what does it mean to you all?
Well, it's a couple of lines in the Stevens-Magnuson Act that gives the National Marine Fisheries power over what they deem essential fish habitat, which I think when the act was written, they were looking at ground fish, bottom draggers, and things like that. Well, the tendency of bureaucracies are to expand their power as far as they can until somebody stops them. And this essential fish habitat, we see it going up the creeks anywhere there's water, and, you know, it'll become like a wetlands problem. One of the things that we see is a potential problem. And there's numerous groups that are working on that, from Senator Stevens right on down to RDC. And it's something, it hasn't fully been expanded yet, and maybe by keeping it on the radar, we can keep control of it. The problem.
So when you say essential fish habitat, you're talking about the regulatory problems that come from those lines being in the National Marine Fisheries.
Right.
And when you talk about wetlands problems, you're talking about the jurisdiction of the Corps of Engineers and others over wetlands and how that impacts mining.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just talking about wetlands.
No, the regulatory. If we see this thing as a wetland problem coming from another side, from National Marine Fisheries.
A wetlands type regulatory.
Based on essential fish, and essential fish habitat, which is a kind of a rough definition that isn't really been fully defined, and, you know, it's one of the things that's looking at the cracks on all legislation.
Thank you.
Senator Lick.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I want to go back to the five-year extensions, and that this is for a 10-year, that I don't know if it's the author of the piece of legislation, but you said that you've been on, so I have to pick on you, that you've been on for a while. This is, as I see it, this would be the fourth extension for the Alaska Minerals Commission, which I support. I totally support. But in there, it says the commission members are appointed by the governor, president of the Senate, and speaker of the House. It doesn't say what the term is for these members, so I'm assuming, I can't find it in here, I'm assuming that that's for a five-year period?
No, I think they serve at the pleasure of the appointee, or the person that appoints them, I believe. And it isn't very clear as to what the term is. There are term limits. And we've had discussion back and forth on some of that.
Well, I guess that was one of the questions that I had. If it was for 10 years, then do they serve for a 10-year period? Maybe that's something that we should, since it is going to be for 10 years, then it should be clearly defined so the folks that are serving understand how long they're going to be in office. But a five-year, I mean, for some people that might seem like a lifetime too, being on this commission. So, and others have a great deal of fun and it passes quickly. But why, since it seemed like there hasn't been any problem with extending it every 5 years, why do you think that a 10-year is more beneficial.
Well, maybe just a perspective. 5 years comes real fast, and that was part of the comment as well. It's been over and over, but let's just put 10 years and go for 10, because it gives a little more permanence to it, and like I say, it isn't 5 years isn't that long. That was why they went to 10, or asked for 10.
That's how you're liking that. Statute says that each member serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority, so it doesn't really specify how long that they're on there. It requires that they have at least 5 years' experience in various aspects of mineral industries in the state. That's it, so I suppose they're on there for...
Yep. Well, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like there was an indication that you all had talked about it at some point, or members had talked about it. Is that any recommendation that you would have back to the legislature of perhaps setting a term so that you know for sure that you're going to be in there? It's not at the whim of the president or the governor or the speaker.
Well, we always figure, you know, at least in my opinion, I'm serving at the whim of the president of the Senate that appointed me. And, you know, he chooses to pick somebody different. I mean, that's his choice. And what we found, actually, when we brought up this discussion, there was one member that brought it up to the limits, and he seemed to think that, well, we'd get some fresh blood. But really, in the history, there's been enough turnover over time from people leaving or other positions. For example, Tom Irwin, who's now the Commissioner of Natural Resources, served on the Mineral Commission, and he's moved on. And so over time, there's been a fair amount of, say, fresh blood and fresh ideas, and that's, you know, and that was more of the context of changing people. It was just to get some new ideas. And it's
how often do you meet?
Three times a year. Usually once in the spring, where we come down here and present the report and meet with the legislature, and then in the fall, there'd be two meetings, an earlier meeting, and then one in November, to put together the report, which is due in December. So.
Do you find that the work that you do in the report that you present gets action and paid attention to?
Oh yeah, I think you know, it depends on the makeup of the legislature, but in the last few years, it's been actually really gratifying to see the work we come in actually turn into something, produce some results. So.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make note that, if I might,
sure, Senator,
that I just came from talking to the Women's History Month. And I'm pleased to see that you have at least two women of 11 members, but I would like to see that expanded. But you probably are not the one I need to talk to.
No, our chairman is Irene Anderson from Nome.
I read that. And there's one other name.
Charlotte PK, yes. Actually, they probably do most of the heavy lifting there.
I'm sure they do.
Right into that.
Yeah.
Senator Allison.
Oh, I'm just trying to bump us off of what could become an uncomfortable discussion. I do support the Minerals Commission. I think it's a model that others have looked at and are making some proposals on for other economic sectors in Alaska also. Having said that, I mean, I can't let this go without the observation. You know, if we had extended the RCA for 10 years, we would have 9 years of bliss.
You're out of order, Mr. before us. Okay. Now that we're having that kind of fun, thank you very much. There's no other questions. We have Irene Anderson online in Nome. How's the weather in Nome today, Irene?
Pretty sunshine, pretty nice.
Hey, just like Juneau.
Yeah, we're waiting for the dog, aren't you?
You got any snow?
Yeah, we have plenty of snow, they're piling it high, so they're doing Front Street next week.
Good. So what, do you want to go ahead and give us your comments on why you think you guys are doing such a good job and need to be extended for 10 years?
Well, I think 10 years would save a whole bunch of people time, like your time, our staff time, discussing this issue every 4 or 5 years, and I totally agree with what Neil said, is that kind of come and go, and but we're a real diverse group, and we do a lot of work, and we think that 10 years in Alaska's history is not very, you know, 10 years is not very long for what could be happening in the future in mining, just in general, coal mining, large load operations, or especially now with the interest to get some of the infrastructure and possibly some infrastructure in rural Alaska looked at, roads or rail, and then the hopefully the increase in the geophysical aeromagnetic mapping and that. 10 years isn't long. I agree with Neil.
And what is your background? I don't have.
My family's plaster miner here in the Nome area. My husband's originally from McGrath, one of the Andersons from there. We mined out of McGrath years ago in the Yankee Creek area, and then he mines here. And my grandfather was a miner here. He just found out. We thought he arrived here in 1908, but I just learned from the recorders that he was here like in 1905. My whole family's been really involved with plaster mining.
Okay. Yep. Is there anybody that has any questions of Irene? Senator Lincoln?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Irene, I just want to thank you for doing the heavy lifting.
Well,
thank you. I'll be down there in a couple weeks. I'll stop and be by here. I'll say hello. Okay. Yeah. Anyone else? Hearing none. Thank you very much, Irene. Thank you for your service to the state.
Yes.
We have Frankie, and it's probably a simple pronunciation, but I'm going to let you do it.
Kilopont.
Kilopont.
Right. And okay. I'm here as staff for the location, okay, in case there were questions that the members couldn't answer.
Okay. And someone has, does anybody have any questions? And you're with DCED?
Correct. Community and Economic Development.
No, I like it when the old name. I'm still stuck on the old name, and it's been, what, 4 or 5 years now? But anyway. Does anyone have any questions, Frankie? Hearing none, what's the... Oh, is there anybody else who would like to testify that either here in the audience or teleconference that has not testified? Hearing none. Does anyone want to move this?
Chairman, I move Senate Bill 79 from committee with the tax risk note. We didn't have any array. Any quick recommendations?
Is there objection moving the bill? Hearing none. It is moved. Let's take an Addies. The Senate Resources Committee back to order, please. We have before us Senate Bill 92. And by the Senate Resources Committee. What this is a bill that reauthorizes the Stranded Gas Development Act. And I can't tell you the hundreds of hours that I worked on this years ago when this thing got going. There's similar legislation that is working its way over from the House. I really don't intend to move this bill today.
Thought I'd get it up on our radar screen for our information. What I'd like to do is get an overview of what the original Stranded Gas Act did. There's a few of us that weren't here when that was going on. There's others that were, maybe weren't. I assume that minority members worked on that when they were, you guys have been on Senate Resources for quite a while. So you're probably pretty familiar, but this has a very, very big impact on the state of Alaska and on the communities especially that are affected by gas development and a pipeline going through their community. And this gives the state a lot of latitude, really, in some ways, to negotiate on the behalf of, negotiate settlements that highly affect local communities. As you know, there's a lot of impact on a community when a gas pipeline project is built through their community just by population showing up and turn off your cell phone before you show up.
Privilege to share.
Anyway, I have Dan Dickinson here from Department of Revenue that's going to give us a briefing on this and try to get us familiar. And I would ask the members to, I mean, the bill is really short. There's not much to the bill. It just pretty much reauthorizes the act. But what I'd like to do for today is to get brief on what the act does and the reasons we passed it and those kind of things. So, Dan, here.
Yeah.
Always online, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Senator Hogan. Chairman Hogan, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you here today. My name is Dan Dickinson, Tax Division Director at the Department of Revenue. With me is Roger Marks, Petroleum Economist of the Tax Division. We'll speak briefly about the history and the mechanics of the Stranded Gas Act. But I think it's important first to introduce ourselves. The Department of Revenue has many responsibilities under the Stranded Gas Act. The Tax Division has equal expertise and experience in oil and gas matters. 5 years ago, we were three separate divisions: the Oil and Gas Audit Division, the Income and Excise Audit Division, and the Charitable Gaming Division. We have subsequently merged into a single division, and sometimes think that was a mistake. We named ourselves the Tax Division. It is what we do, but no one wants to be seen talking to us anymore. So again, I appreciate the chance to come before this committee. What we do can be seen from the fiscal year 2002 Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for the state of Alaska. You should have a copy of an excerpt from the table of 1.13 in the packet of information for my testimony. Of total government fund revenues of $3.5 billion last year, the biggest piece, $1.6 billion, comes from the Fed. Taxes are $1 billion. Royalties are $900 million. And then interest, investment income, all the other ways the government raises money, charges for services, fines, mortgages, printers, are more than offset by investment losses. The Tax Division administers 19 of the 20 tax types that make up that $1 billion tax figure. Of the $1 billion in taxes, all but a couple hundred million are oil and gas taxes. State oil and gas take is often characterized as four bites of the apple, and we are experienced at all four bites. For the first bite, under statute, we are charged with royalties and net profit share leases, and we work with DNR closely on those matters. The other three bites of the apple come in the three areas that we anticipate will be our focus in any Stranded Gas Act negotiation. The second bite of the apple is the oil and gas property tax. Last Friday, to meet our March 1st deadline, the Division of Oil and Gas Property Tax Assessor, his staff, mailed out the 2003 tax roll for oil and gas property valued about $13.5 billion. As Senator Hogan pointed out in his introductory remarks, property taxes play a unique role in determining any natural gas project's profitability and culture. The next bite of the apple is the oil and gas corporate income tax. Income taxes are focused on taxing profits. And Roger will elaborate later on, the more we focus on taxing profits, the more progressive our fiscal system becomes. That is one of the big goals of the Trans Gap Act. We have a large and experienced group in our division that works these issues, and we expect them to be critical. The last bite of the apple is the production tax. Like royalty, the production tax focuses on the commodity value of the resource at or near the wellhead. We have lots of experience in this area, dealing with market pricing, intercompany transfer pricing, how markets work, how energy contracts work, business practices, cost analysis. Let me add a personal observation, but one that I think reflects what many of us in the division believe about what the state should be trying to achieve in these Stranded Gas Act negotiations. Taxes, and the government take in general that is the subject of the Stranded Gas Act, should not distort commercial reality. Government take should not be what is red-lighting this project. As Roger will explain, our current fiscal system intensifies some of the risks faced by the producers. Ironically, not only the producers, but the state would be better off changing these aspects of the fiscal system. The Stranded Gas Act negotiation should be about risk sharing and who among the state and the commercial entities involved best handle. As soon as Senate Bill 92 becomes law, we can start discussing how prices will be shared, or how return on investment in the pipeline will be taxed. We'll really figure out what each party wants to get in this project, by the just or. There are lots of specifics that can be set aside until it's clearer how our gas will fit in with the market mechanism that will be in place when we are ready to market it. State's role does not need to increase risk. We can make this project fly by reducing risk. On the other hand, we have to make sure the state is not naively underwriting a risky project. The only ones who will still be around if things go sour, we don't want to be left holding a bag if you didn't quite understand the dimensions of it. My quick overview of the Department of Revenue Tax Division. Administration strongly supports reauthorizing the Green Gas Act, which creates a great mechanism to work these difficult issues we face, but that individual is born being able to play our part at work. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, introduce the folks who will be doing a lot of the work in the Green Gas Act negotiation. I'm glad to answer any questions you have. I have any Roger Mark or any comments in our division. We'll talk about the gas more specifically. Thank you.
Thank you. So in a nutshell, the original bill allows the state to enter into negotiations to almost on behalf of the municipalities in a way, because a lot of these property taxes, for example, are due to municipalities and that type of thing. Could you give us a little bit of an overview on exactly what do you envision this at the end of the day, what the negotiations would be and what the sticking points are on getting a project built and why we need this?
Certainly, Senator Rogan. I think you correctly identified what's going on with the municipalities. The property taxes could form a very large piece of the fiscal pay. And of course, the way our property taxes are set up, as soon as the project begins, the property taxes are due. In other words, it could be 5 or 6 years before gas will ever flow or any profit will ever flow to the project, but because folks are at work here, there's stacks of pipe or steel in the state, it is taxable. One of the things that we've got to do, one of the tensions here, is of course the municipalities, that is their sole source of revenue from this project. So they're not going to want to see those compromised. Furthermore, the municipalities, that's when they'll need cash the most. In other words, if busloads of folks are showing up from lower 48, there's work camps and there could be all kinds of disruptions or population pressures on the municipalities. On the other hand, when you have to make payments 5 or 6 years before the cash begins to flow into a project, it's very expensive cash because you've got to fund it for 5 or 6 years. So property tax payments really can harm the rate of return on an investment. That's a tension that the state's got to balance. There's a formal mechanism for the municipalities to participate through formal committees to make sure that they understand where we are, that we've got, you know, folks to understand communications, why it should be open. But ultimately, I think the state is charged with making those judgments on behalf of the municipalities and striking that delicate balance.
So basically, if all these taxes are going to be due at when the materials and the equipment gets on the ground, it makes an extra expense for the builders of the pipeline, and we allow them to make negotiate a, memory serves me, a payment in lieu of taxes type scenario. Now, how did it, you know, there aren't any municipal folks that have showed up to testify on this, and we passed this in the past, but it seemed to me if I was a mayor of Fairbanks, for example, or some other place, that I might not have a lot of comfort level with the state negotiating these taxes on my behalf, or these payments in lieu of taxes on my behalf. I'd be interested in seeing maybe some testimony. I know you can't testify on their behalf, but have you got any feedback from some of these folks?
So, yes, we do. And let me make some observations. First of all, as you're aware, of course, this tax or the Transit Gas Act negotiation will be public, but ultimately have to be passed by the legislature. So if there were something were really askew, I believe that would come out of that process and the legislature would have a role in making sure that municipalities had not been left out. The law specifically states that there will be a fair and reasonable share of the payment. So if there's a payment in lieu of taxes, what they may have been focusing on more was how you will arrive at that. But I think the law establishes that the community needs to get a piece of that. Let me back up and give an example. Under our current oil regime, about 80% of the government's take is based on the value of the wellhead. About 10% is based on profits, and about 10% is based on property taxes. If we were to look at a project like this and say, gee, let's switch it over and make it 80% based on profit and smaller pieces on wealth and value and property taxes, what we might do is make sure that the communities got those early dollars because they will need them. But we would the state would not take any of those early dollars, and we would be hoping to be repaid or to make up it, you know, by getting a piece of profit later on. So those are the kind of larger questions that we've got to deal with conceptually in the Stranded Gas Act negotiation.
And how does it work out as time goes on? That the state ends up with their share of these types of taxes and revenue due to them. Is it keep the project from being front loaded, but is there, how does it work out at the end of the project and after the pipe's been amortized and they're making money on it, hopefully? How does the state get their share?
Well, Senator, I believe that's one of the things that we're going to have to determine. We could look at, say, a tax or an income tax that focused, say, on the rate of return built into the tariff in a pipeline. Or we could have a simple measure that, you know, defines the measure of profitability and says, gee, if prices go above X and up, there'll be payments of a certain amount. There are all kinds of mechanisms that can be used, and they're really got to depend on how much price risk we're willing to take or how much we're willing to share, how much completion risk, all kinds of risks, if you will, says is, those are the kinds of things you need to sit down, understand the facts and circumstances that everyone's facing, and negotiate something that makes sense for both parties. So, the state gets its whatever fees of its fair share, and yet we're not overloading the project.
Now, I'm looking at page 11 of the bill, and it says, to section 4382.210, contract terms relating to payments in lieu of one or more taxes. This is of the old bill. The House Bill 393 finance. I don't have it.
What? Is that in the statute, section 4382.210?
Right. And I mean, there's nine taxes here that are listed. There's oil and gas production taxes, oil and gas exploration, production, pipeline transportation, property taxes, oil and gas conservation tax, Alaska net income tax, municipal sales tax and use tax, municipal property tax, municipal special assessments. Comparable tax or levy imposed by a state or municipality, and any other states or tax, state or municipal taxes. So basically, it's given a lot of authority to the commissioner to be, gosh, you know, pretty broad sweeping authority to negotiate these things on behalf of affected municipalities. Now, I understand a circuit breaker in their protection is that the legislature has to approve what these taxes are, this payment in lieu of taxes are, and the whole deal. But I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention that this is what we're talking about, and talking about reauthorizing for if we do get a pipeline project here. It's pretty broad powers. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, Chairman, one piece of good news is that number three of the conservation tax has been repealed, so that's one less tax we have to worry about. I guess it was replaced by another one to be under the other state taxes. But I think, again, you correctly pointed out that the Commissioner of Revenue has enormous powers under the tax. I would observe that the taxes that are currently levied on 4386 property, the Department of Revenue already assesses the values on that property. So we already play a critical role in determining the revenues that are going to be flowing to the department. There's an advisory board that will have the affected municipalities on it that will be able to communicate with the commissioner, make sure that he understands their concerns, and presumably he can talk with them about what he's doing. But you're right. I mean, this essentially identifies the sources by which the localities or the affected localities finance their local operations. And it's going to be a very curious negotiation for them, because it's got a lot to do with how they, whether the project ends up being a benefit for them or something else. So I think you're quite right to identify the power of
there. Mr. Dickinson, I'd like you to consider this. You don't have to answer right away, but I'd like you to consider the legislature's role in this. Of course, we do have a role in the fact that we approved the deal, but I've heard a couple of people in the halls, and I've kicked around the ideas of making sure that someone from the legislature is maybe appointed to some kind of a committee or some kind of oversight to more or less oversee what happens with the negotiation process. I had some problems with the idea of putting it into the bill, because I think it's a separation of powers. Basically, the administration's authority to negotiate and handle this stuff. However, I think it would be in the administration's best interest to have someone from the legislature at the table, at least, if not an active negotiator, certainly at the table when the discussions are going on, so we can report back to our colleagues and maybe with the purposes of saying, yeah, this is a good deal, or maybe we ought to look at some of these other things. What's the administration's position on that, or do you want to think about that?
Well, Senator, I can't speak for the administration, Senator Rogan. I think no administration wants to bring a bill to the House and then sit down at first impression and try to explain it. Clearly, the legislature will be involved. They'll get reports. There are a number of very big picture decisions about the shape of the state's revenue, whether it's just how many risks it wants to bear. I think clearly we're going to be getting input, or the administration's got a lot of input from across a spectrum, and especially the legislature, because if it's something the legislature is not happy with, the conceptual basis on which the negotiation is being made, we might as well not show up with a bill later. So I think if the administration wants to get this Stranded Gas Act negotiation going, and wants a successful one, I mean, they do, that clearly they're going to be involved with the legislature, so that when that bill comes, you'll certainly get all the oversight you need, but that basically it's something that they're fairly certain will result in the system, in the fiscal system, which will then lead to the project. So I think just as a matter of self-interest, they're certainly going to keep the folks who get to vote on it involved.
Okay, well, does anybody else have any questions for Mr. Dickinson? Senator Elton does.
Thanks. Mr. Dickinson, going back to the point that the chair made a few moments ago about the broad powers of the commissioner, I'm assuming that those broad powers, as exercised by the commissioner under this act, include his ability to negotiate different levels with different municipalities. For example, he could say under a municipal property tax, for example, X mills in one jurisdiction and Y mills in another jurisdiction.
Senator, all to the chair. I don't see why not. It is my belief, and maybe this is purely mine, that we would be focusing less on sort of on mills, on the values there, and more on issues such as impact. If, for example, there was one community that had acres that were covered by piles of steel, but nobody was there, and the next community over had a work camp that had huge amount of workforce, folks using the schools, and drawing on other medical resources of the community, you might look at that and say, well, wait a minute, a straight mill rate isn't going to solve that problem. But I don't want to speak too far, but that would be my personal impression. How would that be appropriate?
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Senator Seekers.
Yes, sir. Mr. Dickinson, one question I have is, in looking at Article 3 of the Act and other places, when we're talking about the discretion, if I looked at line 20 on page 10, if the commissioner approves an application and proposed project plan under the statute, the commissioner may develop a contract that may include. He's under no particular requirement to include any of these terms in this chapter, is he? He has broad discretion either to do it or not do it. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Look at one way, the state of Alaska has a set of taxes in place that are, specifically apply that is. The question is, can the commissioner use the powers here to make a better project that is better for the state and better for the folks who want to build the project? But, obviously the negotiator, if he doesn't see anything that's worth negotiating, he can walk away from it. I think that's entirely correct.
Okay, so he just has, in this contract development, he doesn't really have to make, he can make it a very simple contract or a very complex one, then. That's basically what I'm saying.
Senator Zeman, through the chair, yes, if, you know, we don't really know how many things we want to bundle up into this project yet.
Okay, thank you.
And again, you know, since it will be submitted to the legislature, you also will have, you know, perhaps the power to accept parts of it or reject parts of it, but that may not work out for the, you know, it's a carefully crafted compromise.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Dickinson.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear next from Roger Marks, who's also the Department of Revenue.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Roger Marks. I'm a petroleum economist with the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. I've worked on the original Strand Gas Act in 1998, and I'm familiar with its history and kind of mechanics. I would like to provide a very brief overview of the Act at AS 4382. A more detailed synopsis is with the fiscal note. The Act originated in HB 250 in 1997, which established a North Slope Gas Commercialization Team in the administration to research and recommend changes to state law to encourage commercialization of North Slope Gas. It concluded that the project faced considerable risk, namely gas price risk and cost overrun risk, and that the state's fiscal system actually exacerbated those risks. Due to risks of particular concern or fiscal certainty or fiscal uncertainty in the state's regressive tax system. A brief comment on the price risk. The cost of the project is very large, $20 billion. That is a lot of money to any corporation, even ones the size of Exxon, BP, or ConocoPhillips. If this project is built and something goes wrong, such as low prices, the sponsors face very large losses. And even if these are relatively low probability events, the project may not be built if a company simply cannot tolerate the loss of that size. That is why the risk reduction mechanism proposed in Congress, which is currently in place for non-conventional gas in the lower 48, may be a very necessary linchpin in making this project a reality. By fiscal uncertainty, we mean the threat of changes in fiscal provisions after a project is built that may change the project's viability after it is too late to do anything about it. A project may be feasible under one tax system. It is built under the assumption that the tax system in place will stay in place. If the tax system changes, the changes could cause heavy financial losses. Second, there are two significant elements of the state's fiscal system that make it regressive. By regressive, we mean that the state takes a high percentage of income at low prices and a low percentage at high prices. First, the property tax is based on cost. The higher the cost, the higher the tax. This is a double whammy to an investor who incurs a cost overrun. Moreover, the property tax is payable when construction begins years before revenue starts accruing. On a time value of money basis, this diminishes the rate of return and increases the risk of not recovering the investment. The second regressive elements are the severance tax and royalty. They are based on the value at the point where the gas comes out of the ground and ignore upstream costs such as capital and operating costs. Thus, when costs are high and prices are low, state takes a high percentage of low income. Again, this intensifies the danger of low prices. I might add that a regressive system also limits the state's take at high prices. Fixing that would be very important to the state for securing more revenue when prices are high without threatening the viability of the project. Granted Gap Act was the result of trying to fix these shortcomings. The law provides a mechanism for converting the state's fiscal system from a statutory basis to a contractual basis. This would provide for greater fiscal certainty. The fiscal system would be negotiated between the state and the project sponsors and approved by the legislature after a public review period. Payments to the state would be made in lieu of taxes, and through the Act, contract terms would provide for a more progressive or less regressive system. Most of the provisions subject to negotiation are the tax provision. Given that the royalty represents the state's ownership share, there was not interest in making the royalty rate subject to change. The only royalty provision subject engage in developing contract terms, and the act requires that a fair and reasonable share of the payments due under the contract be paid to affected municipalities with due regard to the size of the tax base that may be exempted and the economic and social burdens imposed by construction and operation. The act also has provisions for sponsors to help make gas available to communities, to promote local hire, deal with confidential information provided by their sponsors, and to reimburse the state for contractors it may use to assist in the negotiation process. Finally, there were some questions raised as to whether this would surrender or contract away the power to tax, which is forbidden by our Constitution. It was the administration's judgment that this would not preclude future legislatures from imposing other taxes, but this contract would represent a solid pledge, a moral commitment by the state, and a message to future legislatures that once it agrees to the terms, it will not change them. That concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. March. Now, what provision of the Constitution were we talking about there with the binding future legislatures? The power of what? I didn't quite hear it.
I didn't hear the question.
Your last paragraph, you talked about the constitutional ban on the power of taxes. Is that what it was?
There were questions raised by switching the tax system from a statutory to a contractual basis. Was that surrendering the or contracting away the power to tax? And our Constitution forbids our doing that. Article 9 of the Constitution provides the power of taxation shall never be surrendered. And in 1998, the question came up is by switching the fiscal system from a statutory basis to contractual, would that be indeed surrendering or contracting away the power to tax? It was the judgment of the administration, particularly the Attorney General's office, that no, it was not doing that. The contract would not prohibit future legislatures from imposing taxes. And indeed, insofar as it does not prohibit that, this contract is not airtight in that there could be additional taxes levied by the legislature in future years should they choose to do so. But what this contract represented, again, was and this could be even stated in the contract, that it was a pledge or a moral commitment that the state intended at the time the contract was made not to have taxes raised in the future, but the contract did not preclude that.
Okay. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Marks? Hearing none. Thank you very much for testifying today, Mr. Marks. Appreciate it. Next, we have Mark Myers. And I'm going to temporarily turn the gavel over to the vice chairman, and I'll be right back. Mr. Myers, you want to give us your testimony, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chairman. For the record, I'm Mark Myers, director of the Division of Oil and Gas within DNR. It's hard to overestimate the importance of the gas line, with over 35 TCF proven and over 100 TCF of additional potential gas. A gas pipeline will enable development of Alaska's incredible gas resources for the next 50-plus years. Alaska has and will continue to exceed its original expected. And the gas bill set the stage for a broad-based technical negotiation project sponsors and the administration, and is strongly supported by the administration as a vehicle to accelerate the construction of a North Slope gas line. In addition to dealing with issues involving taxes, the Stranded Gas Act addresses major royalties and resource ownership issues managed by DNR, including royalty in kind and royalty in value, the valuation methodology used for calculating the state's royalty share, and a mitigate the charges for royalty gas. As you know, on the oil side, the safe sale of royalty and kind oil has stimulated Alaska's refining industry with a huge positive effect to the state's economy. The state's royalty and kind sales for our gas could be used as a vehicle for opening a major petrochemical business in this Alaska or for exploration, a currently untapped basin. The Stranded Gas Act also opens the door for negotiations in other key areas involving DNR's resource management role with respect to oil and gas production from state land. While it's premature to discuss the breadth and scope of the negotiations, we know that publicly at least one of the major producers wants to negotiate between units, treatment of carbon dioxide, and other significant technical and economic issues. As the state's manager of the state oil and gas, we as the division oil and gas understand project risk and economic drivers, both from an industry and a government perspective. In fact, among our staff, we have over 100 man years of direct industry experience, most of that working on complex and risky oil and gas exploration and development projects for major producers within the state. For example, one of our geologists was the on-site geologist on the discovery well for Prudhoe Bay. Others, including myself, have worked as geologists, geophysicists, engineers, and drillers on the exploration for and development of many, if not most, of the producing fields and oil and gas projects on the North Slope. Welcome, bringing this expertise along with our extensive knowledge in commercial and regulatory management to support the state's effort in any way the governor will get. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mark, I'm back. Great testimony. Does anyone have any questions, Mr. Myers? Hearing none. Don't have any questions, but thanks for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure.
Sir Stevens.
Between Mr. Dickerson or Mr. Marks or Mr. Meyer. Maybe I can get some clarification of something I've been trying to work out, sifting through this. And it actually has to do with during the initial enactment of HB 393 and the concept of backloading or back-end loading tax liabilities. And the question I have is in relationship to the pardon me if my acronyms aren't right, but there's an issue I believe that's been floating around called the pipeline tariff settlement method. Is that correct? TSM, tariff settlement methodology. And let me explain my thought, and maybe one of you experts can comment on it. But it's my understanding that the tariff settlement method with the pipeline was that the state was going to get their money at the front end, and that the owners or the producers were going to, as the project aged with time, that the state's portion would shrink, or their liability would decrease. Is that a fair interpretation?
This is Mr. Marks. In the oil pipeline, the original tariff were very high, in the order of upwards of $6, as filed by the pipeline owners. What that did was actually lead, since our wellhead values are derived after subtraction of the tariff, what that did was create lower values for severance tax and royalty early on. What happened in TSL, in the settlement method that you refer to, what that did was actually lower tariffs and partially compensate for the high tariffs that were derived early on. So the
didn't start out to be that way intentionally, but as a matter of history, the pipeline tariffs were actually, as far as the state concerned, or as far as the, you know, the sponsors of the pipeline, that was back-end loaded as well, because they got to recover a big chunk of their money in the early years.
So my assumption was wrong, but when the TAP sign essentially began operation, it was back and loaded.
The tariff itself was front end loaded, and what that did was create a back end loaded fiscal system, because a front end loaded, a high tariff on the front end resulted in low severance taxes and royalties for the producers. So a front end loaded tariff created a back end loaded fiscal system.
Right. That's okay. That was the clarification I wanted to get. Thank you.
So if I can build on that a little bit more, so theoretically, if the transportation costs or the tariff is lower because of the costs are lower, this should generate more revenue in the front end of the project for the state.
This is Dan Dickinson.
As far as, you know, well price and net back and all that stuff.
Right, but I think an important observation is that if we choose to get most of our revenue from the wellhead, then the tariff will become very important. And you correctly identified, the higher the tariff, the lower the wellhead.
Right.
But the point is, there are other mechanisms. For example, if we focus a very large piece of the tariff, let me back up here a second. Let's propose that the portion of the pipeline in Alaska costs $10 billion. A very large piece of the tariff is going to be the interest on that $10 billion. It's like the first couple of years when you buy a house, most of the mortgage payments are interest. But that interest is going to be taxable. If we look at it from an income tax point of view, we say that's return on an investment. So if we're focused on that piece, then in fact what happens at the wellhead is less important. And those are the kind of mechanisms that say we need to trade off as we look at how we're going to quantify our fiscal pain.
Right. Yeah.
This is Mr. Mark. I may add another comment
Okay, who is this now?
This is Mr. Mark.
Okay, thank you.
And certainly if this pipeline goes to Chicago, the upper Midwest, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, is going to establish a tariff. It is not envisioned that a tariff would come out of this negotiation process. Now, that is not to say that possibly another way of accounting for the pipeline costs couldn't come out of the negotiation, but the tariff itself, the official tariff as that shippers will have to pay to the pipeline, will be established in a federal jurisdiction.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I just wanted to clarify for myself the definition of actually it was in the original submission of 393 about back end loading in relation to the other large pipeline project we had constructed in the state, how it compared. That is all I was trying to get, just an understanding of that. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions by the committee members? Hearing none. Is there anybody that would like to testify that hasn't? By teleconference or here in the committee room. I'd just like to bring the committee members' attention to the bill itself. It basically extends what we did before for LNG, except that it says it's North Slope Gas. There's a Northern Route ban that in page 2 on subparagraph A there talks about a route that follows generally a route that parallels the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System and Alaska Highway, so it bans an over-the-top route. And then I did, just for the sake of discussion, put a deadline application. So we're saying we'd like to, you know, if we don't have a project in the next few years, whether or not the legislature wants to take up the issue again. So that's, those are the policy calls I think we need to make on this one bill. And to be honest with you, I just kind of picked a date out of the, you know, kind of an arbitrary date, so that's open for discussion and expect to get some comments on that. So I don't have anything else. That's a quick overview of what the bill does. And anybody have any questions or comments? If not, we'll get out of here before 5 o'clock and we're adjourned. Thank you.